seriously popular.
Have you ever felt like escaping to your own desert island? Jane Gaskin did exactly that, trading in the family home to begin a new life in the tropics. But she soon discovers that paradise has its secrets. I'm Alice Levine, and this is The Price of Paradise, the island dream that ends in kidnap, corruption, and murder. Wish you were here? Follow The Price of Paradise now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
In January 2023, Constance Martin and her boyfriend Mark Gordon disappeared and went on the run with their newborn baby, Victoria.
A nationwide search resulted in the sad discovery of Victoria's body, and the pair have now been charged with killing her, which they both deny.
I'm Jack Hardy, a news reporter for the Daily Mail. I'll be in court every day, reporting the events as they happen.
And I'm broadcaster and journalist Caroline Cheetham. Together, we'll take you behind the headlines, bringing you the evidence, witness statements and testimony from the Old Bailey in London.
This is The Trial, Constance Martin and Mark Gordon.
Well, we're back again with another extra episode this week, so we can bring you the final closing speech in this trial at the Old Bailey. So far, we've heard from prosecutor Tom Little, KC, and also from John Femiola, KC, who represents Mark Gordon. Today, Jack will have the details of the closing speech of Constance Martin's barrister. That's Francis Fitzgibbon, KC.
Yeah, so this is the final opportunity for him to urge this jury of six men and five women not to convict her of these charges. And he started by telling them that Constance Martin had been treated with disrespect and hostility throughout the trial.
He said after the death of baby Victoria, the couple were semi-deranged with grief and anxiety.
He told them she deserved empathy, yet she'd been prosecuted as if she was a monster.
And he said the prosecution had dehumanised Victoria, referring to her as it throughout the trial.
Welcome to episode 21. Are any of these things criminal?
Now, I could summarise what I'm going to say to you, really, in a single sentence, which is that what happened to Victoria was no crime, but rather a terrible, tragic accident. Then I could leave it there, then leave it to you. But that wouldn't be doing justice to you, or to the case, or to Ms. Martin. So you'll forgive me, I hope, if I say rather more than that.
Those were the opening words of Francis Fitzgibbon, KC, as he started to make his final plea to this jury that they should not convict Constance Martin of any of the five charges that she faces. He told the jury his client had suffered terrible losses and was not the selfish, arrogant, reckless woman she'd been painted by the prosecution.
Yeah, Caroline, so Francis Fitzgibbon told the court Constance Martin had been really cruelly mischaracterised by the prosecution, who had also failed to prove their case that Victoria had died of hypothermia.
When the prosecution opened their case all those weeks ago, before you heard a word of evidence, before you'd seen Ms. Martin's interviews or seen her give evidence, Mr. Little described her in his opening as reckless, utterly selfish, callous, cruel, arrogant woman. Again, in his closing remarks, he said that she was selfish and arrogant. When the case opened, you might have thought, well, that's pretty strong. But it was then, and in closing, entirely in keeping, you may think, with the aggressive, bullish way that they have prosecuted this woman and run their case. And now you have all the facts. Now you have seen her and got a grip on all the evidence. We suggest that that account of Constance Martin, is simply wrong. It's wrong and it's unfair. It's a mischaracterisation of who she is.
Now, when we heard from the prosecutor, Tom Little Casey, earlier in the week, he said Constance Martin's cross-examination had taken several days because she'd refused to answer the questions that she was being asked. But Mr. Fitzgibbon characterised it very differently.
And he said the prosecution's lack of empathy was demonstrated by the way they referred to Victoria during the trial as it.
She endured, I think, 5 days of hostile cross-examination. She was in that witness box being heavily cross-examined for a very long time. There has been no spark of empathy, much less respect, shown to a woman who has had to live with the loss of her 5 children, 4 taken away from her for adoption, and 1 dead. A dead child, you may think, that was continually referred to as it. Does that show much respect to her, to Victoria, or to the defendant? It. It's jarring and dehumanising, isn't it, from a human tragedy.
He then said, at times, the treatment of Constance Martin by the prosecutors verged on being personal. She was painted as being a monster, he said.
We suggest there were times when you may have thought it was almost personal, was almost vengeful in the way in which she was being dealt with, as if they wanted to make you hate her or fill you with righteous anger, so you would be more inclined to find her guilty. We say that is the wrong approach. This is not one of those terrible cases you read about where parents beat up, torture or shake children to death. You probably remember the terrible Baby P case years ago. This case, you may think, has been prosecuted as though Ms. Martin was a monster, like one of those people. And of course we say she is far from that.
He said he wanted to deal with the suggestion that Constance Martin had carried Victoria in this bag for life when she was still alive.
We say that whenever you see the couple, the baby is being held close to one or other of them. We say it's a smear, no more than that, to have the baby put in the shopping bag at any stage. It's not supported by what you can see, and it's entirely inconsistent with everything you can see.
Now, as John Femiola had done in his closing speech earlier this week, he then addressed the treatment of Professor Peter Fleming. That's the defence expert who said it was highly unlikely that baby Victoria died of hypothermia. Mr. Fitzgibbon said he got a similarly rough ride from the prosecution as his choice of words was picked apart.
He is, as you heard, as you could see for yourselves, a true expert, a real expert. He is no charlatan. He's a leader in his field. And yet he was chivied over non-existent semantic differences between his choice of words when describing the great unlikelihood, extremely, exceedingly, highly unlikely, that the baby died from hypothermia. He was accused, quite wrongly you may think, of being partial.
The prosecutor gave himself away, Mr. Fitzgibbon said, because he had misrepresented the findings of Professor Fleming in his closing speech. He was keen to focus on the median temperatures overnight in the Mongolian tents when Professor Fleming was studying how children were kept warm in freezing temperatures.
But Mr. Fitzgibbon said this deliberately obscured the fact that the temperatures did drop below zero in the tent. And if it was the case that it never dropped below 15 degrees at night, it would have been completely pointless for him to go to Mongolia in the first place to research how young children survive in freezing cold conditions. And then he made use of 2 of the phrases Tom Little himself had used.
It seems that in prosecutor world, to coin a phrase, the wilds of Mongolia in winter remain at a perfectly comfortable temperature. So you were, I'm sorry to say, misled about that part of his research which characterises, we say, again to use the word you've heard before, a rather slack way in which his evidence was approached by the prosecution. So please don't allow yourself to be turned off, Professor Fleming, by the manner in which he was dealt with, or by the details in which the prosecution made great play, and which you may think were points made on a false basis. Victoria's death, we say, was a tragic accident, and no more than that. And when you strip away the tumult and shouting that surround parts of this case, that is what the evidence tells you.
So he asked the jury to recall the police interviews with Constance Martin when he suggested she was treated without proper courtesy and respect. A short clip of the interview was then played to the jury, which showed Constance Martin struggling to contain her emotions as she spoke about the death of her daughter.
That, we say, is the real Constance Martin. We say that what you see there is the genuine grief of a mother who has lost her baby in exactly the circumstances she said, namely a terrible accident. That gives you a real insight into her mind, her attitude, and should cause you at the very least to think twice before you accept those words that the prosecution put before you. You won't forget how she stood up to those long, grueling days of cross-examination. There were moments when her resolve cracked and she became emotional. Hardly a surprise, because the loss of all her children is what she had to endure. And you may think that the mother you see before you now is grieving, and was grieving in January and February last year when baby Victoria died. Enduring grief, or quasi-grief, for the loss of the first four, redoubled by grief for the loss of Victoria. We say you can't assess her fairly, decide this case, without understanding what she was going through then and now. Isn't it obvious that the loss of your children would colour, would pollute pretty much everything else in your life? There can surely be no grief without love, and grief is the ever-present ghost of that love. All losses haunt us. If she was this dreadful, cruel, neglectful mother, why would she continue to show any concern for the four children who have been taken away? You can see she is full of anxiety about how they have been treated by those to whom they've been assigned by the state and the courts to care for them.
The jury were asked by Mr. Fitzgibbon not for their sympathy, but for their empathy. He asked them to try to imagine what it would be like to walk 100 miles in their shoes before they judged. While the jurors had to leave their emotions at the door when reaching their verdict, he said, they could still understand how emotions had played a part in what Constance Martin was doing in December 2022 and January and February 2023.
The story when the couple went on a run in 2023 caused a sensation in the media, Mr. Fitzgibbon said. But Constance Martin was grieving and the enduring sense of grief was there for all to see. He said that although the family court case had been settled, Constance Martin had found it impossible to accept the decision.
A phrase that Mr. Fitzgibbon repeatedly returned to was distinguishing the signal from the noise. Now, this was a reference to trying to find a radio signal through the fuzzy interference. He accepted that sometimes her evidence had digressed and sometimes she had to be steered back to the subject. But he said the prosecution had done the same thing, veering off into what he called irrelevant areas. He said the noise had the effect of masking the real paucity of evidence the prosecution had against the defendants.
So Mr. Fitzgibbon stressed throughout his closing speech that the jury had to be sure that Constance Martin was lying. It wasn't enough to think that it could be true. They had to be sure that it was a lie.
He highlighted the judge's legal directions, which we mentioned earlier this week, which made it clear that if the jury concludes the defendants were not guilty on count two, which is child cruelty, they shouldn't even consider the counts of causing or allowing the death of a child and manslaughter by gross negligence.
He said it was the defence's case that there was no evidence that Victoria died from hypothermia.
Legally guilty is the issue here. As you heard, she feels responsible for what happened, as you may think any decent human being would. She said, I feel guilty as to what happened to Victoria. She was our pride and joy. I was taking great care of her, and I do feel responsible for falling asleep on her if that's what happened. You may think that was spoken with true feeling, and are hardly the words of a cruel, callous, arrogant woman, but a personal acknowledgement that, of course, the mother has responsibility. You say that is 1,000 miles away from being guilty of a crime, and is certainly no confession of a crime. You know from the experts that falling asleep exhausted after breastfeeding a newborn baby can happen anywhere. In a nice warm room, in a nice terraced house, in a hotel room, anywhere. The mother, as you heard, is drained in every sense. Drained physically, drained mentally by the care of a breastfed newborn baby and the constant needs of that baby, and can fall asleep over the baby. That doesn't make it a crime. It makes it a horrible accident.
So Mr. Fitzgibbon then turned in more detail to the child cruelty charge. The prosecution, he said, were required to prove that the couple deliberately exposed her to cold or they neglected her by allowing Constance Martin to fall asleep and smothering her.
Now, this involved two key factual decisions, he said. When did Victoria die and how did she die? He said if the jury concludes that she did not die from hypothermia, but because Constance Martin fell asleep by accident, there was no case at all against her on those three central counts.
So when did Victoria die? We say here, contrary to what Mr. Little said yesterday, the vital piece of evidence that anchors the point in time when she died is the purchase of petrol on January the 12th. She and Mr. Gordon had no use for petrol. They did not have a car, they did not have a generator, nothing that needed petrol as a fuel. If they wanted to light a fire when the weather got colder, they clearly didn't, because the petrol bottle was full. And if any of you have ever tried lighting a campfire with petrol, you know what a bad idea that would be, because it just explodes. That's what petrol does. They didn't use the petrol. The petrol stayed in the bag, full, with their belongings after their arrest. It stayed untouched, with the untouched body of Victoria in that bag. If Victoria was alive for many weeks afterwards, we say that it is just inexplicable that those items remained where they were, in that bag. She had the petrol for the reason that she gave. Do you remember what she said? They were so distraught, she and Mr. Gordon, that they even thought about jumping into the pyre themselves. She had seen bodies cremated that way on her travels. The way she gave that evidence, you might think, came from true feeling.
We'll take a break there.
Have you ever felt like escaping to your own desert island? Jane Gaskin did exactly that, trading in the family home to begin a new life in the tropics. But she soon discovers that paradise has its secrets. I'm Alice Levine, and this is The Price of Paradise, the island dream that ends in kidnap, corruption, and murder. Wish you were here? Follow The Price of Paradise now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
So the eyewitnesses were the next subject that Mr. Fitzgibbon turned to Jack, and he reminded the jury that there was an almost national obsession with finding the couple when they first went on the run in 2023. Now, he said this may have led eyewitnesses to think they saw this couple when actually they were an entirely different couple. He said that believing was often the key with eyewitnesses. Believing is seeing.
So he said none of the witnesses were acting in bad faith and they were genuinely trying to help. But that confirmation bias, which is the tendency to favour information that supports something you want to believe, coloured many of the accounts the jury had heard.
Starting with Dale Gosling, now that's the man in Harwich who offered to take the couple back to his house for a cup of tea. Mr. Fitzgibbon said that just a day earlier, a press release had been issued and widely reported about a couple missing with a newborn baby. And he wondered if it was this phrase that made Mr. Gosling recall that the baby looked just born, that there was mucus on her head and that Constance Martin looked like a mother who had just given birth. He said Mr. Gosling was not an expert neonatologist and there was a danger of what was in the media having a subconscious influence upon a person's recollections.
Now, another witness whose account Mr. Fitzgibbon scrutinised was a woman called Pauline Mason. Now, she was the woman who said she saw the couple in Stanmer Park in Brighton on February the 19th, so this would have been around 6 weeks after Constance Martin said baby Victoria died. She said she saw a woman with dark hair but didn't pay much attention to the woman because she was concentrating on the baby the woman was carrying. She said she thought the baby was dead. So Mr. Fitzgibbon pointed out that she had failed to mention that to the police, only saying it for the first time during her evidence in court.
Let's just consider that for a moment. By February 19, Constance and Mark Gordon had been hiding themselves and their baby for quite some time. They were desperate not to be traced. That is the whole point of being out in the country. But if Mrs. Mason has it right, there they are, walking through a busy park on a sunny Sunday afternoon with a dead baby in their arms for the whole world to see. You may think that's the absolutely last thing that anybody, let alone these two, would be doing. If they've been carrying a dead baby around in a crowded park, you might think everybody would have seen that, and there would have been a tremendous hue and cry. There was not. So we suggest you treat her evidence with the greatest caution. It is, we would suggest, a classic example of a mistaken witness, but a compelling witness because she is so confident in the belief of what she has seen.
Mr. Fitzgibbon also reminded the jury that Pauline Mason's husband had told them in his evidence that she'd always regretted not coming forward as a witness decades earlier when she thought she saw something important following the notorious Babes in the Woods murders in Brighton. She displayed, he said, the perfectly understandable human desire to be part of the story, to play a role. The couple had even said the unfolding hunt for Constance Martin, Mark Gordon and the baby had been a frequent topic of conversation between them and they'd got really interested in the case.
Now, the prosecution, he said, had also developed a fixation on Seaford Golf Course. This was near where a woman called Sarah Hidden believes she saw the couple on a coastal path in around mid to late January. This was a couple of nights after she heard a baby crying. The prosecution said this was significant because police later found a receipt for a round of golf from Seaford Golf Course in a bag in the shed where Victoria's body was found. They claimed this was evidence Victoria may have been alive later than the couple claimed.
But Mr. Fitzgibbon said the jury couldn't simply brush under the carpet the fact that her description of the couple didn't match. The man was tall and the woman was short. She also said the tent she saw pitched nearby was teal green, not blue, like the couple's tent. And he said there was absolutely no reason the crying that she heard in the night had to be Victoria, because there were plenty of houses all around.
The prosecution seemed to have a near obsession with Seaford and the golf course. You will remember what a deal was made of the receipt for Seaford Golf Course that was found in the rubbish that the defendants had accumulated. They didn't play a round of golf in Seaford. It's pretty obvious when they were scavenging in the bins at Hollingbury. Among the stuff they picked up along with random bits of rubbish was someone else's receipt for playing a round of golf in Seaford.
He also said that none of the witnesses that claimed to have seen the couple after January the 12th, which is when the petrol was bought, came close to giving a reliable identification of the couple and their baby. Lots of unreliable bits of identification do not add up to make one reliable bit of identification, he told them. He also pushed back on a suggestion by Mr. Little that there was strong circumstantial evidence in the case. What they actually had was a lot of unimpressive snippets.
Next, Mr. Fitzgibbon wanted to deal with how and when Victoria had died, and he said it was important to bear in mind that Constance Martin had given her account to the police before any kind of post-mortem examination or tests had been carried out. And the results of all of those examinations and tests were consistent with the explanation she gave about how she died, particularly on Professor Fleming's analysis.
Did she know when she told the police when Victoria died that at least one view, we say the better view of the scientific evidence, would be consistent with what she had said? If she didn't know that, then she was taking an enormous punt on saying the baby died when she did, because it could have been exposed as a lie, if that's what it was.
He then asked the jury to turn to a chart of the highest daytime and nighttime temperatures between January the 8th and January the 10th in 2023 in the area the couple were camping. Now, that had been provided previously by a weather expert when he came to give evidence. He quoted again from Mr. Little's opening speech, where he told the jury the couple had started camping in freezing and obviously dangerous conditions.
You can see from those figures that conditions were not freezing. You may recall the expert weatherman saying at that time conditions were not wintry. There was no snow or ice. So there again, right from the outset, the prosecution have put before you a great big fat mistake when they say what conditions were like when they started camping. If that made any impression on you, just be careful to discount it, because the evidence shows that was wrong. If the baby died during the day on January 9, it wasn't toasty warm for sure, but neither was it freezing cold or wintry.
So Professor Fleming's idea of a micro-environment within the warmth of a jacket was important, he said. You didn't need to travel to Mongolia to see that a baby can be kept warm in just the way that Professor Fleming described.
We say that should really put an end to the idea that the baby was ever dangerously or willfully exposed to cold, because she was not.
He said it was a perfectly reasonable thing for experts from different backgrounds to disagree. It was part of the scientific process. But he reminded jurors that no expert had concluded positively that the baby died from hypothermia, just that they could not rule it out.
He then questioned again why it was that the prosecution had been so aggressive in their questioning of Professor Fleming.
Why are the prosecution making such an effort, not just to challenge his opinion, but to discredit him and ruin his reputation? Is it because they can see that if you accept his reasonable evidence, their case is fatally weakened? Didn't it look a bit like a case of playing the man, not the ball, when it came to the way that he was cross-examined the other day? And if he is so unreliable and slack. How come he prepares reports for use in family courts, coroner's courts, criminal courts, appeal courts? Is this prosecutor the first and only person who has unmasked him? He's deceived the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence. He's risen to the top of his profession as an unreliable slacker. His honours are undeserved.
And he reminded the jury of this.
Remember, he tends to advise the prosecution more than the defence in criminal cases.
He said the cross-examination was all noise and the signal amidst the noise is what's important. In the case of Professor Fleming, he said, the signal was that on the evidence, death from hypothermia is not a fit.
We submit that the medical and scientific evidence falls far short of proving that Victoria became hypothermic and died as a result, and therefore any allegation that she was willfully, dangerously, negligently exposed to cold so as to cause serious harm is wrong. It's just wrong. The evidence isn't there.
The other side of the prosecution case, he said, was paradoxical, because they say, on the one hand, that baby Victoria died of hypothermia, but that even if she didn't, the defendants were still guilty of all the charges if Constance Martin fell asleep on her.
You may think death by asphyxiation, smothering, is no part of the prosecution case at all. It is a defence case that she raised in her interview and has been developed here before you. It's that case that the prosecution is so desperate to discredit. But if what she says about it is, or may be, true, then she can't be guilty. It's an accident. The proposition is that the circumstances in which Constance fell asleep makes falling asleep criminally negligent. But if you don't accept that there's anything criminal in the way she fell asleep, then that's the end of the story.
He then turned to Constance Martin's rich and privileged background and said being from wealth was not always a blessing.
You might think that from 2017 at the latest, her life was not happy. It may be that excessive wealth and even being the beneficiary of a trust fund can be a curse as much as a blessing. All that questioning about her money and her family is a distraction, more noise and less signal, perhaps even worse than that. The comment made yesterday about her upstairs-downstairs attitude is just throwing a nasty bit of class prejudice, isn't it? Throwing another smear at her. What does that prove?
Mr. Fitzgibbon told the jury that Constance Martin had been candid with them in court, candid almost to the point of folly, he said, and he reminded them that she had accepted she would lie to protect her family. The fact she admitted this, he said, is itself proof of her truthfulness here in court.
Of course she could have done things differently, and she probably wishes she had. You probably don't think that all the decisions she made were the best decisions, but we have the luxury of hindsight. We are not alienated from our families. We are not being pursued across the country. We don't want to keep our baby secret. They lived in their present. To understand the case and get the right answer, you need to try and imagine it from their point of view, not just with the hindsight available.
Mr. Fitzgibbon finished his closing speech by addressing the other two charges, perverting the course of justice and concealing a birth. He said the evidence showed they were semi-deranged with grief, anxiety and fear in the aftermath of the baby's death. If they had wanted to cover up everything, he said, they had the potential to. They had the bottle of petrol.
Instead, he said, they were blundering around for all those weeks. They were scavenging for food, almost feral, and not really knowing what the hell they were doing. This was not a cunning plan that they'd worked up.
Finally, he urged the jury to return verdicts of not guilty.
If it was purely accidental, that she fell asleep because she was exhausted, then where is the crime? Was there a serious, obvious risk there? What was it? What did she do that created such an obvious risk? Keeping her warm in her jacket in a tent? Falling asleep? Getting away from unwanted attention? Are any of these things criminal? As you know, tragic events can happen, and they can happen anywhere. And when they do, it's a tragic accident.
So that's it for today. We'll be back next week with the comments from the judge Mark Lewcroft as he sums up the evidence before he asks the jury to retire to consider its verdict.
Constance Martin and Mark Gordon deny manslaughter by gross negligence. They also deny perverting the course of justice, concealing the birth of a child, child cruelty, and causing or allowing the death of a child.
You can follow us on X at The Trial Podcast and contact us on thetrial@mailmetromedia.co.uk.
You can leave us a comment on Spotify or even send us a voice note on WhatsApp on 07796 657 512. Start your message with the word trial.
See you then.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.